"Hey, buddy, how you doing?" he murmured. "I mean, what the haps?" The lunatic lunged at the cop and put his hands on the cop's throat. The instant he did this, the cop slipped the muzzle of his gun into the hollow of the lunatic's temple and pulled the trigger. A great spray of blood leaped through the graying hair on the opposite side of the lunatic's head, and he fell back to the sidewalk, throwing both arms out melodramatically. "Look, Ma, I'm dead." Clay looked at the little man with the mustache, and the little man with the mustache looked at him. Then they both looked back at the cop, who had holstered his weapon and was taking a leather case from the breast pocket of his uniform shirt. Clay was glad to see that the hand he used to do this was shaking a little. He was now frightened of the cop, but would have been more frightened still if the cop's hands had been steady. And what had just happened was no isolated case. The gunshot seemed to have done something to Clay's hearing, cleared a circuit in it or something. Now he could hear other gunshots, isolated cracks punctuating the escalating cacophony of the day. The cop took a card, Clay thought it was a business card, from the slim leather case, then put the case back in his breast pocket. He held the card between the first two fingers of his left hand, while his right hand once more dropped to the butt of his service weapon. Near his highly polished shoes, blood from the lunatic's shattered head was pooling on the sidewalk. Close by, Powersuit Woman lay in another pool of blood, which was now starting to congeal and turn a darker shade of red.
"What's your name, sir?"
the cop asked Clay. "Clayton Riddell."
"Can you tell me who the president is?"
Clay told him.
"Sir, can you tell me today's date?"
"It's the 1st of October. Do you know what's..." The cop looked at the little man with the mustache.
"Your name?"
"I'm Thomas McCourt, 140 Salem Street, Malden. I..."
"Can you name the man who ran against the president in the last election?"
Tom McCourt did so.
"Who is Brad Pitt married to?"
McCourt threw up his hands.
"How should I know? Some movie star, I think."
"Okay."
The cop handed Clay the card he'd been holding between his fingers.
"I'm Officer Ulrich Ashlin. This is my card. You may be called on to testify about what just happened here, gentlemen. What happened was you needed assistance. I rendered it. I was attacked. I responded."
"You wanted to kill him," Clay said.
"Yes, sir. We're putting as many of them out of their misery as fast as we can," Officer Ashlin agreed. "And if you tell any court or board of inquiry that I said that, I'll deny it. But it has to be done. These people are popping up everywhere. Some only commit suicide, many others attack."
He hesitated, then added,
"So far as we can tell, all the others attack."
As if to underline this, there was another gunshot from across the street, a pause, then three more, in rapid succession, from the shadowed forecourt of the Four Seasons Hotel, which was now a tangle of broken glass, broken bodies, crashed vehicles, and spilled blood.
"It's like the fucking Night of the Living Dead."
Officer Ulrich Ashland started back toward Boylston Street with his hand still on the butt of his gun.
"Except these people aren't dead. Unless we help them, that is."
"Rick!"
It was a cop on the other side of the street calling urgently.
"Rick, we gotta go to Logan! All units, get over here!"
Officer Ashland checked for traffic. There was none. Except for the wrecks, Boylston Street was momentarily deserted. From the surrounding area, however, came the sound of more explosions and automotive crashes. The smell of smoke was getting stronger. He started across the street, got halfway, then turned back.
"Get inside somewhere," he said. "Get undercover. You've been lucky once. You may not be lucky again."
"Officer Ashland," Clay said.
"Your guys don't use cell phones, do you?"
Ashland regarded him from the center of Boylston Street. Not, in Clay's opinion, a safe place to be. He was thinking of the rogue duck boat.
"No, sir," he said. "We have radios in our cars, and these."
He patted the radio in his belt, hung opposite his holster. Clay, a comic book fiend since he could read, thought briefly of Batman's marvelous utility belt.
"Don't use them," Clay said. "Tell the others. Don't use the cell phones."
"Why do you say that?"
"Because they were."
He pointed to the dead woman and the unconscious girl.
"Just before they went crazy. And I'll bet you anything that the guy with the knife..." "Rick!"
the cop on the other side shouted again.
"Hurry the fuck up!"
"Get undercover,"
Officer Ashland repeated, and trotted to the Four Seasons side of the street.
Clay wished he could have repeated the thing about the cell phones, but on the whole, he was just glad to see the cop out of harm's way. Not that he believed anyone in Boston really was. Not this afternoon. Chapter 4.
What are you doing? Clay asked Tom McCourt. Don't touch him. He might be, I don't know, contagious.
I'm not going to touch him, Tom said, but I need my shoe. The shoe, lying near the splayed fingers of the lunatic's left hand, was at least away from the exit spray of blood. Tom hooked his fingers delicately into the back and pulled it to him. Then he sat down on the curb of Boylston Street, right where the Mr. Softy truck had been parked in what now seemed to Clay like another lifetime, and slipped his foot into it.
The laces are broken, he said. That damn nutball broke the laces.
And he started crying again. Do the best you can, Clay said. He began working the butcher knife out of the portfolio. It had been slammed through with tremendous force, and he found he had to wiggle it up and down to free it. It came out reluctantly, in a series of jerks, and with ugly scraping sounds that made him want to cringe. He kept wondering who inside had gotten the worst of it. That was stupid. Nothing but shock, think, but he couldn't help it.
Can't you tie it down close to the bottom?
Yeah, I think so. Clay had been hearing a mechanical mosquito whine that now grew to an approaching drone. Tom craned up from his place on the curb. Clay turned around. The little caravan of BPD cars pulling away from the Four Seasons halted in front of city lights and the crashed duck boat with their gumballs flashing. Cops leaned out the windows as a private plane, something mid-sized, maybe a Cessna or the kind they called a twin bonanza, Clay didn't really know planes, came cruising slowly over the buildings between Boston Harbor and the Boston Common, dropping fast. The plane banked drunkenly over the park, its lower wing almost brushing the top of one autumn-bright tree, then settled into the canyon of Charles Street, as if the pilot had decided that was a runway. Then, less than 20 feet above the ground, it tilted left, and the wing on that side struck the facade of a gray stone building, maybe a bank, on the corner of Charles and Beacon. Any sense that the plane was moving slowly, almost gliding, departed in that instant. It spun around on the caught wing as savagely as a tether ball nearing the end of its rope, slammed into the red brick building standing next to the bank, and disappeared in bright petals of red-orange fire. The shockwave hammered across the park. Ducks took wing before it. Clay looked down and saw he was holding the butcher knife in his hand. He had pulled it free while he and Tom McCourt were watching the plane crash. He wiped it first one way and then the other on the front of his shirt, taking pains not to cut himself. Now his hands were shaking. Then he slipped it very carefully into his belt, all the way down to the handle. As he did this, one of his early comic book efforts occurred to him. A bit of juvenilia, actually.
Joxer the pirate stands here at your service, my pretty one, he murmured.
What? Tom asked. He was now beside Clay, staring at the boiling inferno of the airplane on the far side of Boston Common. Only the tail stuck out of the fire. On it, Clay could read the number LN6409B. Above it was what looked like some sports team's logo. Then that was gone, too. He could feel the first waves of heat begin to pump gently against his face.
Nothing, he told the little man in the tweed suit. Leave us boogie.
Huh?
Let's get out of here.
Oh, okay. Clay started to walk along the southern side of the common, in the direction he'd been heading at 3 o'clock, 18 minutes and an eternity ago. Tom McCourt hurried to keep up. He really was a very short man.
Tell me, he said. Do you often talk nonsense?
Sure, Clay said. Just ask my wife. Chapter 5.
Where are we going? Tom asked. I was headed for the tea.
He pointed to a green-painted kiosk about a block ahead. A small crowd of people were milling there.
Now I'm not sure being underground is such a hot idea.
Me either, Clay said. I've got a room at a place called the Atlantic Avenue Inn about 5 blocks further up. Tom brightened.
I think I know it. On Loudon, actually. Just off Atlantic.
Right. Let's go there. We can check the TV. And I want to call my wife.
On the room phone.
The room phone. Check. I don't even have a cell phone.
I have one, but I left it home. It's broken. Rafe, my cat, knocked it off the counter. I was meaning to buy a new one this very day, but... Listen, Mr. Riddell.
Clay.
Clay, then. Are you sure the phone in your room will be safe?
Clay stopped. He hadn't even considered this idea. But if the landlines weren't okay, what would be? He was about to say this to Tom when a sudden brawl broke out at the T-station up ahead. There were cries of panic, screams, and more of that wild babbling. He recognized it for what it was now, the signature scribble of madness. The little knot of people that had been milling around the gray stone pillbox and the steps going below ground broke up. A few of them ran into the street, two with their arms around each other, snatching looks back over their shoulders as they went. More, most, ran into the park, all in different directions, which sort of broke Clay's heart. He felt better somehow about the two with their arms around each other. Still at the T-station and on their feet were two men and two women. Clay was pretty sure it was they who had emerged from the station and driven off the rest. As Clay and Tom stood watching from half a block away, these remaining four fell to fighting with each other. This brawl had the hysterical, killing viciousness he had already seen, but no discernible pattern. It wasn't three against one or two against two, and it certainly wasn't the boys against the girls. In fact, one of the girls was a woman who looked to be in her middle 60s, with a stocky body and a no-nonsense haircut that made Clay think of several women teachers he'd known who were nearing retirement. They fought with feet and fists and nails and teeth, grunting and shouting and circling the bodies of maybe half a dozen people who had already been knocked unconscious or perhaps killed. One of the men stumbled over an outstretched leg and went to his knees. The younger of the two women dropped on top of him. The man on his knees swept something up from the pavement at the head of the stairs. Clay saw with no surprise whatever that it was a cell phone, and slammed it into the side of the woman's face. The cell phone shattered, tearing the woman's cheek open and showering a freshet of blood onto the shoulder of her light jacket, but her scream was of rage rather than pain. She grabbed the kneeling man's ears like a pair of jug handles, dropped her own knees into his lap, and shoved him backwards into the gloom of the T's stairwell. They went out of sight, locked together, and thrashing like cats in heat.
"Come on,"
Tom murmured, twitching Clay's shirt with an odd delicacy.
"Come on. Other side of the street, come on."
Clay allowed himself to be led across Boylston Street. He assumed that either Tom McCourt was watching where they were going, or he was lucky, because they got to the other side okay. They stopped again in front of Colonial Books, best of the old, best of the new, watching as the unlikely victor of the T-station battle went striding into the park in the direction of the burning plane, with blood dripping onto her collar from the ends of her zero-tolerance gray hair. Clay wasn't a bit surprised that the last one standing had turned out to be the lady who looked like a librarian or Latin teacher a year or two away from a gold watch. He had taught with his share of such ladies, and the ones who made it to that age were, more often than not, next door to indestructible. He opened his mouth to say something like this to Tom. In his mind it sounded quite witty, and what came out was a watery croak. His vision had come over shimmery, too. Apparently Tom McCourt, the little man in the tweed suit, wasn't the only one having trouble with his waterworks. Clay swiped an arm across his eyes, tried again to talk, and managed no more than another of those watery croaks.
"That's okay,"
Tom said.
"Better let it come."
And so, standing there in front of a shop window, filled with old books surrounding a royal typewriter hailing from long before the era of cellular communications, Clay did. He cried for Power Suit Woman, for Pixie Light and Pixie Dark, and he cried for himself, because Boston was not his home, and home had never seemed so far. Chapter 6. Above the common, Boylston Street narrowed and became so choked with cars, both those wrecked and those plain abandoned, that they no longer had to worry about kamikaze limos or rogue duck boats, which was a relief.
From all around them, the city banged and crashed like New Year's Eve in hell. There was plenty of noise close by as well, car alarms and burglar alarms mostly, but the street itself was for the moment eerily deserted. "Get undercover," Officer Ulrich Ashland had said. "You've been lucky once. You may not be lucky again." But, 2 blocks east of Colonial Books and still a block from Clay's not-quite-fleabag hotel, they were lucky again. Another lunatic, this one a young man of perhaps 25, with muscles that looked tuned by Nautilus and Cybex, bolted from an alley just in front of them and went dashing across the street, hurdling the locked bumpers of 2 cars, foaming out an unceasing lava flow of that nonsense talk as he went. He held a car aerial in each hand and stabbed them rapidly back and forth in the air like daggers as he cruised his lethal course. He was naked except for a pair of what looked like brand new Nikes with bright red swooshes. His cock swung from side to side like the pendulum of a grandfather clock on speed. He hit the far sidewalk and side-wheeled west, back toward the common, his butt clenching and unclenching in fantastic rhythm. Tom McCourt clutched Clay's arm, and hard, until this latest lunatic was gone, then slowly relaxed his grip.
"If he'd seen us," he began.
"Yeah, but he didn't," Clay said. He felt suddenly, absurdly happy. He knew that the feeling would pass, but for the moment he was delighted to ride it. He felt like a man who has successfully drawn to an inside straight with the biggest pot of the night lying on the table in front of him.
"I pity who he does see," Tom said.
"I pity who sees him," Clay said. "Come on."
Chapter 7. The doors of the Atlantic Avenue Inn were locked. Clay was so surprised that for a moment he could only stand there, trying to turn the knob and feeling it slip through his fingers, trying to get the idea through his head. Locked. The doors of his hotel locked against him. Tom stepped up beside him, leaned his forehead against the glass to cut the glare, and peered in. From the north, from Logan, surely, came another of those monster explosions, and this time Clay only twitched. He didn't think Tom McCourt reacted at all. Tom was too absorbed in what he was seeing.
"Dead guy on the floor," he announced at last. "Wearing a uniform, but he really looks too old to be a bellhop."
"I don't want anyone to carry my fucking luggage," Clay said. "I just want to go up to my room." Tom made an odd little snorting sound. Clay thought maybe the little guy was starting to cry again, then realized that sound was smothered laughter. The double doors had Atlantic Avenue Inn printed on one glass panel, and a blatant lie, Boston's finest address, printed on the other. Tom slapped the flat of his hand on the glass of the left-hand panel, between Boston's finest address and a row of credit card decals. Now Clay was peering in, too. The lobby wasn't very big. On the left was the reception desk. On the right was a pair of elevators. On the floor was a turkey-red rug. The old guy in the uniform lay on this, face down, with 1 foot up on a couch and a framed Courier Knives sailing ship print on his ass. Clay's good feelings left in a rush, and when Tom began to hammer on the glass instead of just slap, he put his hand over Tom's fist.
"Don't bother," he said. "They're not going to let us in, even if they're alive and sane."
He thought about that and nodded. "Especially if they're sane." Tom looked at him wonderingly.
"You don't get it, do you?"
"Huh? Get what?"
"Things have changed. They can't keep us out."
He pushed Clay's hand off his own, but instead of hammering, he put his forehead against the glass again and shouted. Clay thought he had a pretty good shouting voice on him for a little guy.
"Hey! Hey in there!"
A pause. In the lobby, nothing changed. The old bellman went on being dead with a picture on his ass.
"Hey! If you're in there, you better open the door. The man I'm with is a paying guest of the hotel, and I'm his guest. Open up or I'm going to grab a curbstone and break the glass, you hear me?"
"A curbstone?" Clay said. He started to laugh.
"Did you say curbstone?
Jolly good." He laughed harder. He couldn't help it. Then movement to his left caught his eye. He looked around and saw a teenage girl standing a little way farther up the street. She was looking at them out of haggard, blue, disaster-victim eyes. She was wearing a white dress, and there was a vast bib of blood on the front of it. More blood was crusted beneath her nose, on her lips and chin. Other than the bloody nose, she didn't look hurt. And she didn't look crazy at all, just shocked. Shocked almost to death. "Are you all right?" Clay asked. He took a step toward her, and she took a corresponding step back. Under the circumstances, he couldn't blame her. He stopped, but held a hand up to her like a traffic cop. "Stay put." Tom glanced around briefly, then began to hammer on the door again, this time hard enough to rattle the glass in its old wooden frame and make his reflection shiver.
"Last chance! Then we're coming in!"
Clay turned and opened his mouth to tell him that masterful shit wasn't going to cut it, not today, and then a bald head rose slowly from behind the reception desk. It was like watching a periscope surface. Clay recognized that head even before it got to the face. It belonged to the clerk who checked him in yesterday and stamped a validation on his parking lot ticket for the lot to block over, the same clerk who'd given him directions to the Copley Square Hotel this morning. For a moment, he still lingered behind the desk, and Clay held up his room key with the green plastic Atlantic Avenue Inn fob hanging down. Then he also held up his portfolio, thinking the desk clerk might recognize it. Maybe he did. More likely, he just decided he had no choice. In either case, he used the pass-through at the end of the desk and crossed quickly to the door, detouring around the body. Clay Riddell believed he might be witnessing the first reluctant scurry he had ever seen in his life. When the desk clerk reached the other side of the door, he looked from Clay to Tom and then back to Clay again. Although he did not appear particularly reassured by what he saw, he produced a ring of keys from one pocket, flicked rapidly through them, found one, and used it on his side of the door. When Tom reached for the handle, the bald clerk held his hand up much as Clay had held his up to the blood-stained girl behind them. The clerk found a second key, used this one in another lock, and opened the door.
"Come in," he said. "Hurry."
Then he saw the girl, lingering at a little distance and watching.
"Not her."
"Yes, her," Clay said. "Come on, honey." But she wouldn't, and when Clay took a step toward her, she whirled and took off running, the skirt of her dress flying out behind her. Chapter 8 "She could die out there," Clay said.
"Not my problem," the desk clerk said. "Are you coming in or not, Mr. Riddell?"
He had a Boston accent, not the blue-collar, Southie kind Clay was most familiar with from Maine, where it seemed that every third person you met was a Massachusetts expat, but the fussy, I-wish-I-were-British one. "It's Riddell." He was coming in all right. No way this guy was going to keep him out now that the door was open, but he lingered a moment longer on the sidewalk, looking after the girl.
"Go on," Tom said quietly. "Nothing to be done."
And he was right. Nothing to be done. That was the exact hell of it. He followed Tom in, and the desk clerk once more double-locked the doors of the Atlantic Avenue Inn behind them, as if that were all it would take to keep them from the chaos of the streets. Chapter 9
"That was Franklin," said the desk clerk as he led the way around the uniformed man lying face down on the floor.
"He looks too old to be a bellhop," Tom had said, peering in through the window, and Clay thought he certainly did. He was a small man with a lot of luxuriant white hair. Unfortunately for him, the head on which it was probably still growing, hair and nails were slow in getting the word, or so he had read somewhere, was cocked at a terrible crooked angle, like the head of a hanged man.
"He'd been with the inn for 35 years, as I'm sure he told every guest he ever checked in. Most of them twice."
That tight little accent grated on Clay's frayed nerves. He thought that if it had been a fart, it would have been the kind that comes out sounding like a party horn blown by a kid with asthma.
"A man came out of the elevator," the desk clerk said, once more using the pass-through to get behind the desk.
Back there was apparently where he felt at home. The overhead light struck his face, and Clay saw he was very pale.
"One of the crazy ones. Franklin had the bad luck to be standing right there in front of the doors.
I don't suppose it crossed your mind to at least take the damn picture off his ass, Clay said. He bent down, picked up the Courier and Ives print, and put it on the couch. At the same time, he brushed the dead bellman's foot off the cushion where it had come to rest. It fell with a sound Clay knew very well. He had rendered it in a great many comic books as clump. The man from the elevator only hit him with one punch, the desk clerk said. It knocked poor Franklin all the way against the wall. I think it broke his neck. In any case, that was what dislodged the picture, Franklin striking the wall. In the desk clerk's mind, this seemed to justify everything. What about the man who hit him? Tom asked. The crazy guy, where'd he go? Out, the desk clerk said. That was when I felt locking the door to be by far the wisest course, after he went out. He looked at them with a combination of fear and prurient, gossipy greed that Clay found singularly distasteful. What's happening out there? How bad has it gotten? I think you must have a pretty good idea, Clay said. Isn't that why you locked the door? Yes, but what are they saying on TV? Tom asked. Nothing. The cable's been out. He glanced at his watch. For almost half an hour now. What about the radio? The desk clerk gave Tom a prissy, you-must-be-joking look. Clay was starting to think this guy could write a book, How to Be Disliked on Short Notice. Radio in this place? In any downtown hotel? You must be joking. From outside came a high-pitched wail of fear. The girl in the blood-stained white dress appeared at the door again and began pounding on it, with the flat of her hand, looking over her shoulder as she did so. Clay started for her, fast. No, he locked it again, remember? Tom shouted at him. Clay hadn't. He turned to the desk clerk. Unlock it. No, the desk clerk said, and crossed both arms firmly over his narrow chest to show how firmly he meant to oppose this course of action. Outside, the girl in the white dress looked over her shoulder again and pounded harder. Her blood-streaked face was tight with terror. Clay pulled the butcher knife out of his belt. He had almost forgotten it, and was sort of astonished at how quickly, how naturally, it returned to mind. Open it, you son of a bitch, he told the desk clerk, or I'll cut your throat. Chapter 10 No time, Tom yelled, and grabbed one of the high-backed, bogus Queen Anne chairs that flanked the lobby sofa. He ran it at the double doors with the legs up. The girl saw him coming and cringed away, raising both of her hands to protect her face. At the same instant, the man who had been chasing her appeared in front of the door. He was an enormous construction worker type, with a slab of a gut pushing out the front of his yellow T-shirt and a greasy salt-and-pepper ponytail bouncing up and down on the back of it. The chair legs hit the panes of glass in the double doors, the two legs on the left shattering through Atlantic Avenue Inn, and the two on the right through Boston's finest address. The ones on the right punched into the construction worker type's meaty yellow-clad left shoulder, just as he grabbed the girl by the neck. The underside of the chair's seat fetched up against the solid seam where the two doors met, and Tom McCourt went staggering backward, dazed. The construction worker guy was roaring out that speaking-in-tongues gibberish, and blood had begun to course down the freckled meat of his left bicep. The girl managed to pull free of him, but her feet tangled together, and she went down in a heap, half on the sidewalk and half in the gutter, crying out in pain and fear. Clay was standing framed in one of the shattered glass door panels, with no memory of crossing the room, and only the vaguest one of raking the chair out of his way. "Hey, Dickweed!" he shouted, and was marginally encouraged when the big man's flood of crazy talk ceased for a moment, and he froze in his tracks. "Yeah, you!" Clay shouted. "I'm talking to you!" And then, because it was the only thing he could think of, "I fucked your mama, and she was one dry hump!" The large maniac in the yellow shirt cried out something that sounded eerily like what the power suit woman had cried out just before meeting her end, eerily like, "Rast!" and whirled back toward the building that had suddenly grown teeth and a voice and attacked him. Whatever he saw, it couldn't have been a grim, sweaty-faced man with a knife in his hand leaning out through a rectangular panel that had lately held glass, because Clay had to do no attacking at all. The man in the yellow shirt leaped onto the jutting blade of the butcher knife. The Swedish steel slid smoothly into the hanging, sunburned wattle beneath his chin, and released a red waterfall. It doused Clay's hand, amazingly hot, almost hot as a freshly poured cup of coffee, it seemed, and he had to fight off an urge to pull away. Instead, he pushed forward, at last feeling the knife encounter resistance. It hesitated, but there was no buckle in that baby. It ripped through gristle, then came out through the nape of the big man's neck. He fell forward. Clay couldn't hold him back with one arm, no way in hell. The guy had to go 260, maybe even 290, and for a moment leaned against the door like a drunk against a lamppost, brown eyes bulging, nicotine-stained tongue hanging from one corner of his mouth, neck spewing. Then his knees came unhinged, and he went down. Clay held onto the handle of the knife and was amazed at how easily it came back out, much easier than pulling it back through the leather and reinforced particle board of the portfolio. With the lunatic down, he could see the girl again, one knee on the sidewalk and the other in the gutter, screaming through the curtain of hair hanging across her face. "Honey," he said, "honey, don't." But she went on screaming. Chapter 11. Her name was Alice Maxwell. She could tell them that much. And she could tell them that she and her mother had come into Boston on the train, from Boxford, she said, to do some shopping, a thing they often did on Wednesday, which she called her short day at the high school she attended. She said they'd gotten off the train at South Station and grabbed a cab. She said the cab driver had been wearing a blue turban. She said the blue turban was the last thing she could remember, until the bald desk clerk had finally unlocked the shattered double doors of the Atlantic Avenue Inn and let her in. Clay thought she remembered more. He based this on the way she began to tremble when Tom McCourt asked her if either she or her mother had been carrying a cell phone. She claimed not to remember, but Clay was sure one or both of them had been. Everyone did these days, it seemed. He was just the exception that proved the rule. And there was Tom, who might owe his life to the cat that had knocked his off the counter. They conversed with Alice. The conversation consisted, for the most part, of Clay asking questions while the girl sat mutely, looking down at her scraped knees and shaking her head from time to time, in the hotel lobby. Clay and Tom had moved Franklin's body behind the reception desk, dismissing the bald clerk's loud and bizarre protest that, "It will be just under my feet there." The clerk, who had given his name simply as Mr. Riccardi, had since retired to his inner office. Clay had followed him just long enough to ascertain that Mr. Riccardi had been telling the truth about the TV being out of commish, then left him there. Sharon Riddell would have said Mr. Riccardi was brooding in his tent. The man hadn't let Clay go without a parting shot, however. "Now we're open to the world," he said bitterly. "I hope you think you've accomplished something." "Mr. Riccardi," Clay said, as patiently as he could, "I saw a plane crash land on the other side of Boston Common not an hour ago. It sounds like more planes, big ones, are doing the same thing at Logan. Maybe they're even making suicide runs on the terminals. There are explosions all over downtown. I'd say that this afternoon all of Boston is open to the world." As if to underline this point, a very heavy thump had come from above them. Mr. Riccardi didn't look up. He only flapped a "begone" hand in Clay's direction. With no TV to look at, he sat in his desk chair and looked severely at the wall. Chapter 12. Clay and Tom moved the two bogus Queen Anne chairs against the door, where their high backs did a pretty good job of filling the shattered frames that had once held glass. While Clay was sure that locking the hotel off from the street offered flimsy or outright false security, he thought that blocking the view from the street might be a good idea, and Tom had concurred. Once the chairs were in place, they lowered the sun blind over the lobby's main window. That dimmed the room considerably and sent faint prison bar shadows marching across the turkey red rug. With these things seen to, and Alice Maxwell's radically abridged tale told, Clay finally went to the telephone behind the desk. He glanced at his watch. It was 4:22 p.m., a perfectly logical time for it to be, except any ordinary sense of time seemed to have been canceled. It felt like hours since he'd seen the man biting the dog in the park. It also seemed like no time at all. But there was time, such as humans measured it anyway, and in Kent Pond, Sharon would surely be back by now at the house he still thought of as home. He needed to talk to her, to make sure she was all right, and tell her he was too, but those weren't the important things. Making sure Johnny was all right, that was important. But there was something even more important than that. Vital, really. He didn't have a cell phone, and neither did Sharon. He was almost positive of that. She might have picked one up since they'd separated in April, he supposed, but they still lived in the same town. He saw her almost every day, and he thought if she'd picked one up, he would have known. For one thing, she would have given him the number, right? Right. But Johnny had one. Little Johnny G, who wasn't so little anymore, 12 wasn't so little, and that was what he'd wanted for his last birthday. A red cell phone that played the theme music from his favorite TV program when it rang. Of course, he was forbidden to turn it on or even take it out of his backpack when he was in school, but school hours were over now. Also, Clay and Sharon actually encouraged him to take it, partly because of the separation. There might be emergencies or minor inconveniences, such as a missed bus. What Clay had to hang on to was how Sharon had said she'd look into Johnny's room lately and more often than not see the cell lying forgotten on his desk or the windowsill beside his bed, off the charger and dead as dog shit. Still, the thought of John's red cell phone ticked away in his mind like a bomb. Clay touched the landline phone on the hotel desk, then withdrew his hand. Outside, something else exploded, but this one was distant. It was like hearing an artillery shell explode when you were well behind the lines. Don't make that assumption, he thought. Don't even assume there are lines. He looked across the lobby and saw Tom squatting beside Alice as she sat on the sofa. He was murmuring to her quietly, touching one of her loafers and looking up into her face. That was good. He was good. Clay was increasingly glad he'd run into Tom McCourt, or that Tom McCourt had run into him. The landlines were probably all right. The question was whether probably was good enough. He had a wife who was still sort of his responsibility, and when it came to his son, there was no sort of at all. Even thinking of Johnny was dangerous. Every time his mind turned to the boy, Clay felt a panic rat inside his mind, ready to burst free of the flimsy cage that held it and start gnawing anything it could get at with its sharp little teeth. If he could make sure Johnny and Sharon were okay, he could keep the rat in its cage and plan what to do next. But if he did something stupid, he wouldn't be able to help anyone. In fact, he would make things worse for the people here. He thought about this a little, and then called the desk clerk's name. When there was no answer from the inner office, he called again. When there was still no answer, he said, "I know you hear me, Mr. Riccardi. If you make me come in there and get you, it'll annoy me. I might get annoyed enough to consider putting you out on the street." "You can't do that," Mr. Riccardi said in a tone of surly instruction. "You are a guest of the hotel." Clay thought of repeating what Tom had said to him while they were still outside. Things have changed. Something made him keep silent instead. "What?" Mr. Riccardi said at last, sounding more surly than ever. From overhead came a louder thump, as if someone had dropped a heavy piece of furniture, a bureau maybe. This time even the girl looked up. Clay thought he heard a muffled shout, or maybe a howl of pain, but if so, there was no follow-up. What was on the second floor? Not a restaurant, he remembered being told by Mr. Riccardi himself when Clay checked in, that the hotel didn't have a restaurant, but the Metropolitan Cafe was right next door. Meeting rooms, he thought. I'm pretty sure it's meeting rooms with Indian names. What? Mr. Riccardi asked again. He sounded grouchier than ever. Did you try to call anyone when all this started happening? Well, of course, Mr. Riccardi said. He came to the door between the inner office and the area behind the reception desk, with its pigeonholes, security monitors, and its bank of computers. There he looked at Clay indignantly. The fire alarms went off. I got them stopped. Doris said it was a wastebasket fire on the third floor, and I called the fire department to tell them not to bother. The line was busy. Busy, can you imagine? You must have been very upset, Tom said. Mr. Riccardi looked mollified for the first time. I called the police when things outside started, you know, to go downhill.
Yes, Clay said. To go downhill was one way of putting it, all right. Did you get an answer?
A man told me I'd have to clear the line and then hung up on me, Mr. Riccardi said.
The indignation was creeping back into his voice.
When I called again, this was after the crazy man came out of the elevator and killed Franklin, a woman answered. She said...
Mr. Riccardi's voice had begun to quiver, and Clay saw the first tears running down the narrow defiles that marked the sides of the man's nose.
Said?
What? Tom asked in that same tone of mild sympathy. What did she say, Mr. Riccardi?
She said, if Franklin was dead, and the man who killed him had run away, then I didn't have a problem. It was she who advised me to lock myself in. She also told me to call the hotel's elevators to lobby level and shut them off, which I did.
Clay and Tom exchanged a look that carried a wordless thought. Good idea. Clay got a sudden vivid image of bugs trapped between a closed window and a screen, buzzing furiously, but unable to get out. This picture had something to do with the thumps they'd heard coming from above them. He wondered briefly how long before the thumper, or thumpers up there, would find the stairs.
Then she hung up on me. After that, I called my wife in Milton.
You got through to her, Clay said, wanting to be clear on this.
She was very frightened. She asked me to come home. I told her I had been advised to stay inside with the doors locked. Advised by the police. I told her to do the same thing. Lock up and keep a, you know, low profile. She begged me to come home. She said there had been gunshots on the street and an explosion a street over. She said she had seen a naked man running through the Benzicks' yard. The Benzicks live next door to us.
Yes, Tom said mildly, soothingly even. Clay said nothing.
He was a bit ashamed at how angry he'd been at Mr. Riccardi.
But Tom had been angry, too.
She said she believed the naked man might, she only said might, have been carrying the body of a nude child, but possibly it was a doll. She begged me again to leave the hotel and come home.
Clay had what he needed. The landlines were safe. Mr. Riccardi was in shock, but not crazy. Clay put his hand on the telephone. Mr. Riccardi laid his hand over Clay's before Clay could pick up the receiver. Mr. Riccardi's fingers were long and pale and very cold. Mr. Riccardi wasn't done. Mr. Riccardi was on a roll.
She called me a son of a bitch and hung up. I know she was angry with me, and of course I understand why. But the police told me to lock up and stay put. The police told me to keep off the streets. The police! The authorities!
Clay nodded. The authorities, sure.
Did you come by the tea? Mr. Riccardi asked. I always use the tea. It's just 2 blocks down the street. It's very convenient.
It wouldn't be convenient this afternoon, Tom said. After what we just saw, you couldn't get me down there on a bet. Mr. Riccardi looked at Clay with mournful eagerness.
You see?
Clay nodded again. You're better off in here, he said, knowing that he meant to get home and see to his boy. Sharon, too, of course, but mostly his boy. Knowing he would let nothing stop him unless something absolutely did. It was like a weight in his mind that cast an actual shadow on his vision. Much better off. Then he picked up the phone and punched 9 for an outside line. He wasn't sure he'd get one, but he did. He dialed 1, then 207, the area code for all of Maine, and then 692, which was the prefix for Kent Pond and the surrounding towns. He got 3 of the last 4 numbers, almost to the house he still thought of as home, before the distinctive 3-tone interrupt. A recorded female voice followed. We're sorry. All circuits are busy. Please try your call again later. On the heels of this came a dial tone as some automated circuit disconnected him from Maine, if that was where the robot voice had been coming from. Clay let the handset drop to the level of his shoulder, as if it had grown very heavy.
Then he put it back in the cradle.